This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Hey everyone, Trace here. The following episode on Copycat was actually recorded as part of Salem Horror Fest, which took place last month. That is October 2020 for anyone listening to this in the future. Because of COVID-19, this was a virtual broadcast as opposed to an in-person live appearance, but we still had a blast doing it. Unfortunately, we did have a tiny technical issue towards the end of the recording, so you'll notice a slight downgrade in audio quality for the last 25 minutes of the episode, but you'll still be able to hear and understand everything just fine. Also, since this was recorded as a special episode, we don't do our standard housekeeping at the end where we announce the film we're covering next week, so I'll go ahead and do that right now. Next week, Joe and I will be covering a film directed by previous guest Carter Smith. Listen to our episode on The People Under the Stairs if you haven't, because he's very insightful. Anyway, that film is 2008's The Ruins, the killer Vine movie that did not get its due when it was released 12 years ago. So give that a watch over the weekend, and we'll see you next week.
This is the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
Welcome back to Horror Queers. It's a very special Salem Horror Fest edition, and we're talking about squirrel covers, and we're talking about pocket cheeseburgers, and we're talking about Sigourney fucking Weaver! And I'm Joe.
And I'm Trace, and I'm going to say welcome to Horror Queers for anyone who's never listened to us before. And we're talking red high-heeled shoes, slow motion dropping off a toilet. We're talking Copycat, y'all.
We should always have red high heel shoes dropping off of a toilet, obviously.
I always forget the slow-mo effect. Like, it's so focused on, like, this, like, really dramatic dropping of this fucking shoe. It's also, y'all, we're an R-rated podcast. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and also we spoil things. So if you haven't seen Copycat in the 25 years since it's been out, spoiler warning. We're going to ruin the end of this movie for you.
We should have had a birthday cake. It is its 25th anniversary this month on October 27th. Bah!
We're already fucking up.
Well, okay. So for anyone who's never listened to us before, we are the Horror Queers. Again, Trace Thurman, Joe Lipsit. Well, he's on this side of my screen over here. Maybe he's not in the recording. Who knows?
It's working.
We are part of the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network, and we basically look at various horror films through a queer lens. The films can have an explicit queer element, they can have camp factors, they can have just a queer following, or we may just want to talk about them. I don't know, we can make anything queer. But before I go too much further into this, I do want to mention that we have a very special guest on today's episode. So, ladies and gentlemen and everyone in between, they are the festival director of, well, this festival, Salem Horror Fest. So please welcome Kay Lynch to the podcast, everybody.
Hello. Am I here? Yes, I'm here.
Yes, you're here.
I just materialized.
Welcome, Kay. Yeah.
Thank you. Finally, we did it. I'm so glad. I've been listening to you guys for since the beginning? It's been 2 years now?
Almost 2 years. Almost two years. Yeah. We're coming up on the big two. The big number two.
Well, how many episodes? Maybe that'll sound better.
There we go. Yeah. So we'll be celebrating our 100th episode next month.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And thank you for having us on. This is actually my first time meeting you. So this is really fun. And I guess everyone watching, it's their first time meeting us. So,
happy October, y'all.
Yes, happy October, and happy first time viewing of Copycat for UK. How was that experience?
Yeah, I can't believe I missed this. It's ticks all the boxes. It's awesome. I love Sigourney and Holly Hunter, and to see them both in the cop procedural where they're the leads working together to solve a crime is really cool and really unique.
And just so mid-90s.
It is. And I think when it came out, it got really kind of unfairly compared to other prestige films that were coming out around the same time, but it's really one that I think has kind of earned, I don't want to say it's a cult following over the years, but it's definitely acquired a following. Like, for me, like, I had never heard of this movie before, and, you know, back when I was a wee one, I used to stay with my grandparents once a month, 1 week every summer, and my uncle, I hate this term, it's my gay uncle, but the gunkle. He had this movie on VHS, and I remember when I was like going through it, because he always had this extensive movie collection, and I would go and I would pick through all of his shit, and I remember I grabbed Copycat, and he walked in on me like holding it, and he was like, oh, that is Sigourney Weaver's best movie. I don't watch all that alien shit she does.
So that's the alien shit.
That's how I got introduced to Copycat.
My sister and I used to watch this a lot. I think we must have also had a VHS copy, but it was one of those things where my parents didn't get too worried because it's a relatively bloodless film. Mm-hmm. So I think they thought that it was a safer option, and they're like, oh, it's two strong female leads, you know, not worrying about the fact that, oh, it's also evoking some of the worst serial murders in human history, but, you know, that's fine. We don't have to worry about that.
I'm just imagining, like, your mom back then going like, oh, those two female leads, that's okay.
I don't even know if my parents knew who Holly Hunter was. They probably would have been like, that chick from The Piano.
Raising Arizona, maybe?
Maybe.
I don't know.
My parents are actually not big movie fans at all. They have no idea where my sister and I get it from.
I feel so bad I haven't upgraded to Blue yet. I still have, like, the snap case of, like...
Oh, the snap case.
With the reversible, oh. Like, one side's full screen, one side's widescreen. Ah!
There we go.
I've got the blue.
Okay, well, so can see.
I think I haven't grabbed it yet because they haven't updated the bonus features yet. Like, it's still,
there's
like...
There's nothing on it.
Dude, I don't know if your Blu-ray has this, but the DVD special features, there's like a cast and... No, it's just like, it's cast and crew, and it's like a slideshow of text of, like, behind-the-scenes information on the film. Oh, no.
What? That's more than I got. I just got the audio commentary with the director and, ooh, theatrical trailer.
Previews.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, and Kay, you and I both listened to the commentary with director John Amiel today, and that is actually a commentary made in 1998... For the DVD, for this one, this DVD that I have, so.
Okay.
It's a bit dated.
I mean, it's a little annoying when these films celebrate big milestones, like 25 years for this movie, and let's be honest, this is really good roles for both of these lead actresses, and it's frustrating that nobody recognizes, hey, you know, I recognize that the film didn't do a huge box office back in the day, but it's got a very big cult following. We could probably make some money off of reissuing a special features DVD with a little bit more extras on it.
Well, I actually, no, because Kay, you said you'd missed it. Had you heard of it before we asked you to come on this episode before?
Not really. I vaguely remember the cover art, but it was not really that prominent in sort of my recollection of that time. Watching it now, I'm actually surprised, and since I've been talking about it lately, a ton of people have been like, oh my god, I love that movie. But I haven't really heard people talk about it.
No, and I'm not trying to single you out and be like, you're a bad queer. But I think that's going towards to be like, I don't think this movie's talked about enough. And I'm hoping that enough people watch this that maybe haven't heard of the movie or haven't seen it to where they will want to seek it out. Or at least give it a rewatch, because this is a movie that I can probably, like, I can rewatch this any day of the week. It's one of those, like, movies for me where I'm like, this is just really fun. It's a really fun horror light movie? I don't know. But yeah, the chemistry between the two leads really sells it.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a two-hour film either. Like, when I put it on to rewatch it before this podcast, you know, you hit play and you just see, oh, 2 hours. Like, what are they possibly filling? And I know some people are going to quibble the stuff with Will Patton in the precinct with the Chinatown crew and that kind of stuff. Maybe we don't need to have it, but at the end of the day, I actually think that the interior life of Holly Hunter's character is important, particularly if we want to apply a queer lesbian reading to this, because she basically needs to kick these men to the curb and then go and spend a lot of time at Sigourney Weaver's place.
Yes. I mean, again, she's not the only explicitly queer character in this film is Sigourney Weaver's roommate, Andy, played by John Rothman. But yeah, I mean, I think you get real big lesbian energy off of the scenes between Weaver and Hunter in this. And there's obviously a very friendly chemistry between them, but you can kind of, like, There's sparks there, if I may say so.
Yeah, I think it's an opposites attract. I've actually read reviews online where people say, the two women don't seem to like each other all that much. And I'm like, that's called sexual tension.
Also, like, they're trying to solve a horrific crime. I don't know that dating is really on top of mind. Although, they're also, like, it seems like a big group of swingers. Because Holly Hunter has had a previous relationship with Bill Patton. Apparently, the current relationship with...
Ruben.
Yeah. And then, yeah, flirting with Sigourney. And Sigourney, knowing that Holly and Ruben are together, flirts with him, too. And is like, hey, tell your guy that, like, thanks for last night. And I'm like, whoa, he's right. These people are TDF.
But it's interesting, though, because in the original draft of the screenplay, and there were several drafts that they to get to where the film is today, the Holly Hunter character of MJ was a male character, and they were going to have a romantic relationship with the Sigourney Weaver character. And so as they were developing it, they were like, we don't really need a romance in this movie where, like, as Kate rightfully pointed out, they're trying to solve a series of gruesome murders. It doesn't make any sense.
And yet the chemistry is there, nonetheless.
Well, and I mean, I'll just fucking throw it out right there. I really do think this movie owes a huge debt to Silence of the Lambs, both in the female leads and also its general structure. It's not completely the same, but again, when this movie came out, it was compared to Silence of the Lambs a lot, despite coming out 4 years later. And you can see those parallels, but I think this movie still does a really good job of distinguishing itself from that film.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the 90s, they're basically rife with these kinds of, I don't want to say low stakes, but like they're pretty straightforward crime procedurals. And this makes sense if you think about it, right? Like, it's a very easy bread and butter kind of genre, or subgenre rather, to put together. So you just have to have a bit of good chemistry with your lead detectives, and then you've got some gruesome murders. But like, we had this in Silence of the Lambs, and then we got a bunch of derivative knockoffs and other, you know, crime adjacent kind of movies. So it feels like if Silence of the Lambs hadn't made such a cultural impact and won fucking Oscars and cemented the two lead actors in that film as, like, these main big deals in Hollywood, I don't know that we would be referencing it all the time when every film that kind of uses the same tropes comes out. Like, it just, it smacks of lazy journalism to me, and I don't really like it.
It also feels very much like a Law & Order episode, which is only like 5 years after the show took off.
I think maybe that's why. I mean, so I rewatched, obviously, this movie, and I did rewatch Silence of the Lambs last night as well, just so I could, like, kind of get a feel for it. This does feel more procedural. It feels, and I think the idea of the copycat doing different killers, it feels very episodic. Usually that would be a complaint for me, that it doesn't feel like there's really a hole here. But I think that Amiel and screenwriters and Biderman and David Madsen, they do a really good job of still making it feel like a fleshed out feature film that just kind of has the episodic elements aren't the focus here, even though they are central to the plot.
Yeah, I mean, just in case people haven't seen the film, should we mention what the distinguishing, like, police procedural elements are? That'd be helpful.
Sure. What are they, Joe?
I mean, in this case, we've got two different killers. So we've got the one that Sigourney Weaver is afraid of at the beginning. So it's the person who kind of sets the stage and introduces the crime. And then we've also got a main serial killer that they're hunting. But there's also regular things, like we've got the serial killer leaving phone calls. We've got notes at the crime scene. We've got elements where they stand around. They talk about the various evidence of, you know, on the bodies. They're looking at photos, they're on the internet, 1995 internet.
Yes.
We will have things to say about the size of an AVI file later on. But it's very much like, have you seen a crime thriller before? Good. Here's all the things that you're going to recognize. And they're here and present, accounted for in Copycat.
Mm-hmm.
And all the interpersonal relationships between the cops. Very, you know, you could tell they've got a life and a history beyond the movie.
And that's the thing for me, you know, that's something that shouldn't work for me. That's something that I'm like, oh, like, I'm watching these two women, like, these two strong, powerful women, like, duke it out and try to find a killer. But I've also got to watch this, like, cop drama. That sounds boring, but it works because it's a combination of the writing and the chemistry. Like, even fucking Patton's character, who should be, like, a non-entity completely. You feel bad for him by the end of the movie.
Yeah, and I think it's a testament to the actors, and they're really selling it, but it's strange that we're actually not getting a ton of some of these characters, and yet they still do pop. Like, you still actually care about Patton. You care about whether or not he gets his closure with Holly Hunter's character. Like, I would dare to say you even care about fucking Andy when he gets murdered at the gay bar, even though you've really had three scenes with him in the entire film. Like, it's a testament to this film that all of these characters are working in supporting roles.
Andy's kind of like the only, like, normal, drama-free character in the film. He's kind of like... I don't know.
He's literally like, really... bye, I'm just going out to the bar.
Yeah. Like... Oh, don't worry. She faints all the time. She'll be good in, like, 30 minutes.
I think we'll have a lot to talk about Andy when we get to, I mean, really his death, kind of, because there's a lot to discuss about this, the one gay character in the film that we know of, who does kind of get the short shrift in terms of an arc, but again, like, it still works for me, because I still like this character. Like, we get to see enough of Andy to where it pays off for me, but I'll hold off on that. So yeah, let's just kind of go into this, why this film wasn't that successful. So Copycat is released on October 27th, 1995 by Warner Brothers Pictures. We got a runtime of 123 minutes, which, by the way, is 5 minutes longer than Silence of the Lambs. We're looking at a budget of $20 million. Now, we've kind of hinted at it, but yeah, this film, it wasn't a bomb. It ended up grossing $32 million domestically, but it opened at the number 4 slot in the box office with about $5 million. Now, this is behind Get Shorty in its second week, and then also Victor Salva's Powder in its first week, and Wes Craven's Vampire in Brooklyn also in its first week. So this movie was, like, out of all the new releases in this weekend, was the worst one, which is kind of surprising considering it's Halloween weekend 1995, but I digress.
But we're also 1995, right? Which is firmly in the horror fucking sucks and we hate it.
Yes, but the real issue here is this. So while this film was compared to Silence of the Lambs a lot, it also had the misfortune of being released about a month after Seven, David Fincher's Seven. And that went on to gross about $100 million domestically, but it's kind of a similar concept. I mean, obviously, Seven's a bit more stylized, you know, it's Fincher. But that is two male detectives looking for a serial killer. And now you have this other film, which is admittedly a bit lighter in terms of tone, which is two female detectives hunting for a serial killer. And it does a third of the business. And I think the word of mouth from Seven was just too much, and it just kind of overshadowed this release. You know, people didn't want to go see or honestly, maybe Seven depressed everyone so much, and they were like, well, I don't want to go see another one of those movies.
Oh God, there's two women. That means we could end up with two ladies' heads in boxes. Because women being murdered is funny.
Yeah.
As evidenced by Copycat, where mostly women die.
But we don't really see, well, I was going to say we don't see them die, but also in Seven, we don't really see people die either.
But in Seven, Silence of the Lambs, other films, it's really they're films about violence against women. But in Copycat, it's a movie about women dealing with the violence against women. So I think it is one of the big things that sets it apart.
I agree. And I mean, like, you know, like, in Silence of the Lambs, you have Clarice doing her own thing, but she's really working on her own or with Scott Glenn's Jack Crawford, so she always has that kind of male father figure there. And she's also a trainee, whereas here you have two seasoned vets. Now, granted, you have Weaver's character, who is not at the top of her game, we'll say, but I just think it allows for so much more, and this isn't to say that I think this is a better film than Silence of the Lambs, but, you know, personal taste. But there's just something there that you're not getting in that film, or Seven, for that matter. Honestly, I feel like people that, if they had seen Seven, they can go see this and be like, oh good, a happy movie.
Yeah, I mean, this to me actually feels a little fresher than Seven, which is, like, maybe I'll get dragged over the coals for that. But I think Seven is telling a more familiar story in a really visually innovative way. And it's doing it really, really well. It's not to say that one is better than the other, but I think we're still in a time frame, like, in the mid-90s, we're not often seeing two females leading a film. And we're certainly not seeing it in this subgenre, right? Like, you're maybe lucky if you get one female lead, and she's usually the partner, right? Like, she's the one who's going to fuck up, and the guy's going to have to save her because she gets kidnapped by some guy at the end, which does happen here. But it's like, it even inverts that by having the mentor figure be the one who gets kidnapped.
Well, I think having a female co-writer, and I think that she's probably the main writer because the other co-writer, David Matson, hasn't really done much of note since this, other than like a TV movie in 97. But Anne Biderman, like, I think having a female write this is probably going to be your key here. And she also clearly has knowledge in like procedurals because she also was a co-writer on Primal Fear with Richard Gere and Edward Norton. Went on to go create the TV show Ray Donovan. Anyway, so this movie, again, not a hit, not a flop, blah, blah, blah. But again, as we mentioned, it's kind of developed this following. And I do think that a good chunk of this following is from the queer community. And I don't know why. I know why, because you've got these two strong female characters. But it doesn't, like, this movie doesn't scream queer to me. And I don't know, does it to y'all?
I didn't think it was, I mean, I think at the time, the fact that Andy's role, as small as it is, was still bigger than what we would get at the time. He got a lot of screen time. All things considered, he had a name. He had his own kind of thing going on.
He had a name.
Yeah, no, like he
we were reaching clearly, for the stars at this point.
Yeah. No, he was clearly an important person in Sigourney's life. And I think it's also a testament to the performance. I think he brings a lot to it. And then, you know, they show him in a gay club, you know, living his life. Sadly, that was the end of it. But
living the end of his life.
Yeah.
All the way to the end.
But I mean, still in the mid-90s, we did not get many gay club scenes. Never mind a character willing to pretend to be gay for the sake of their plot.
Say what you will about Peter Foley, but that is a serial killer willing to go to the gay bar to get victims.
Was he, like, did they already establish, like, were they already flirting and then he picked up a drink and spiked it? Or did he, like, spike it first and then it was like, hey, here's a drink for you, drink it? Because I was trying to figure, like, did they already establish a connection before he got the drink?
Well, he's on a date, like, or he's going to the bar with, no? I thought it was a romantic interest.
No, I think those were friends, like, going out for a night out. So Andy and his friend leave Sigourney Weaver's place, and then I think they go to the bar, they start chatting up this young guy who's taking an interest in them, because they are a little bit older, and I think he's like, you know what, I'm going to get the next round. He goes, he makes the telephone call, he roofies the drink, he comes back. Mm-hmm. That's how I've always read it.
Yeah, I mean, but he's such a small part, of the film. I really do think it's the combo, it's the 1-2 punch of Hunter and Weaver that, like, screams gay to me in this.
Well, I could watch them do anything.
And it doesn't hurt that their performances are fucking great in this movie, that they have really good chemistry with one another. So it's not just like, oh, queer diva icons in this movie together. You're like, yeah. Okay, yeah. Oh, that, like, this does happen.
Although I will say, I adore Sigourney, and I do love watching her in this movie, but I don't think she's necessary. I think she's great. I don't know that she's well cast.
Well, let's dive into that a little bit. She's playing against type, though, because she is normally playing, like, badass women. I mean, you know, this is, like, right after Aliens, and after she plays, oh my god, is it Diane Fossey? Diane Fossey in Gorillas of the Mist? Like, she's known for playing these really strong, powerful female characters, and she is now not. I mean, she is, but she's not. So, where are you getting that from?
I don't know, it was just hard to, maybe it's just because of that typecast, it was hard for me to imagine her as being so vulnerable. So yeah. her moments of like, oh my gosh, I'm scared to get the newspaper. I don't know, I think she did the best you could with that, but I'm so used to Sigourney just being able to take on xenomorphs.
I'm picturing you writing this review like, I just didn't buy that she couldn't get that newspaper.
Like, what, was there a xenomorph on the other side?
And I understand, like, she's dealing with trauma and all this, but it was just for Sigourney in particular, and that's probably a big reason of what brought her to this role, was because it was against type. But I just found it a little difficult to imagine her like struggling in that way because of Sigourney, the superstar, the actor.
I think a big part of it, though, too, is a lot of the agoraphobic scenes. You have Sigourney acting, but you also have the camera and Amiel doing a lot of work to get that across. So it's almost like the portrayal of agoraphobia is like 50-50. It's like 50 her performance and 50 what Amiel's doing with the camera. So that also may be kind of what you're taking from it, too.
Yeah, there's almost like a sense of distrust that you can't just have Sigourney Weaver acting her fucking ass off trying to get this newspaper. It's like, okay, well, we really got to sell what this experience is like for her, because people may not know what agoraphobia is. So let's really move that camera. And you're like, okay. Like,
yeah, it was a bit melodramatic.
I mean, this movie is melodrama.
That's true. That is true.
But I think though, maybe we can discuss it. I mean, once we get into the plot in a second, like, we can do that. But I think, you know, it's not a campy movie, but I think there are elements of camp in this that,
yeah,
that also kind of make it more queer. Unintentionally, yeah. So, probably.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. I remember the first time I saw this, I definitely was like, what is up with Harry Connick Jr.'s performance in this movie?
And he fought for that role. The director was like, no. And he was like, no, I can do this. I can do it.
He was like, I will dye my hair red and I will act like a yeehaw local for you for this role.
I've got a weird cousin who uses the term squirrel covers.
Oh my God. Squirrel covers.
It sounds like he based like a lot of his improvisations on... Was it his cousin or someone related to him? And it's like, who is this person?
Also, are they in prison? Because...
Right. right.
What is going on here? Are they a sexual predator? Should we be worried?
Yeah. Okay, well, here, I'll go through some just reception really quick, and then we'll just dive right into this plot. So, the reception's mostly good at the time. It's got a 78% of Rotten Tomatoes with an average score of 6.66 out of 10. Then we're looking at a Letterboxd score of 6.2 out of 10.
That's really good.
I mean, again, when you put it up against Silence of the Lambs, and I guess, even 7, it's maybe not as good. It's like, you know, it's come in bronze, really. But not for us.
I think the big difference is style. Those films are extremely, you know, like, saturated with style. And I don't know. Copycat feels more like a TV drama than sort of an exercise of cinema.
Which was probably also an element of why it wasn't taken as seriously. But Weaver has said that this is the one role of hers that she's upset like the movie didn't do better, because she was really proud of her work in this movie. I mean, despite her unbelievable agoraphobic acting.
Okay, he's never going to let you down.
I know. Hey, I think
it is a compliment to her.
It is, absolutely. But yes, okay, Joe, take us away.
All right, so we open on Dr. Helen Hudson, played by Sigourney Weaver, and she is delivering a lecture to a packed lecture hall. And after a very fun exercise that highlights how bland white serial killing men are...
Wait, let's say, it's basically all white men between the ages of 20 and 35... That's it. That's your profile, everyone.
Well, it's a process of elimination, right? Like, she's basically weeding out anybody who's too young, too old, or too colored. And it's like, look, it's all of your incels and all of your TERFs and all of the people who deliver hate on the internet only back in 1995. So you had to make them stand up physically in a classroom.
Oh, but they clean up graffiti, so they're, like, really good people.
yeah. I mean, they're delivering public service before they go in and shoot people multiple times and then are allowed to walk. Oh, okay. Sorry. No, we're not a political podcast, right? Trace is like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
It could be a lot of people.
We're just talking about one of many, many shootings that have happened because of white men, like the people who stand up in this movie.
Oh, yeah, that.
Right. And they also don't necessarily, you know, they don't, you're not like, oh, hi, I'm clearly a serial killer. They can be, you know, your boy next door, your volunteer at the food pantry. It could be anyone.
That's actually something I like. Well, we'll get to... something I like about the killer in this movie is that he's just like an everyman. Also, his characterization isn't big. Like, this isn't a Hannibal Lecter we're talking about. It's not John Doe. It's just a regular guy who is honestly kind of sad and pathetic. Like, that's kind of my favorite thing about it.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that I love about the Peter Foley character is the fact that he is almost like an unformed individual. Like, he can't even define himself enough to have a serial killer profile. He has to copy other people. Like, that's how boring he is.
That's the thing. Like, being a copycat's kind of like bottom of the barrel, like, serial killer, right? Yeah. Like other serial killers, if there was like a social media of serial killers, like, they would be the losers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's also to provide a stark contrast from Daryl too, because he's clearly like, you know, you would meet Daryl and be like, oh, where are the bodies buried?
So wait. So what you're saying is the Daryl Lee Cullum characters of Robert Downey Jr., he's like the Silence of the Lambs of the serial killers, and then Peter Foley is like the copycat of the copycat killers.
Oh my god, I don't even know if I like that comparison. Go away.
That is so mean. Okay, yeah, so she does this one thing, and everybody's like, oh, but I would date that guy.
You're so good, Helen Hudson.
Well, in the commentary, John talks about, the director talks about how the way it's set up, you've got the stage, the video, the live feed of her giving the presentation for the audience, and then, of course, the camera of the film. You have these different sort of squares and modes of viewing other people that John says was intended to sort of like show how the serial killer sort of views reality in this sort of distorted way.
Well, it's also voyeuristic too. It kind of calls to mind like you, the audience, are here watching this horror thriller movie for violence. And so it's kind of like the multi-screen thing. We've been seeing that a lot lately, I feel like, too. But it always calls to mind Funny Games for me.
I mean, I like it because it also anticipates the way that they view crime scenes as, like, photographs or, like, on the computer screen. So it's almost cueing you to, like, look closer at the media, because that's actually where we're also going to see clues that will lead us to Peter at the end of the day. Anyway, so speaking of Peter Foley, he is actually in this crowd. So there's a bunch of people who watch this movie and never realize it, because of course you don't know to look for him. But if you watch it a second time, you'll see he is one of the men who stands up. So Helen has actually done her work. She has identified that there is a serial killer in this crowd, and he does fit the MO. Okay, so after she delivers her lecture, she's like, sweet, I'm just going to use the ladies. So she goes in, her security detail checks it out, everything looks fine except for a fake pair of ladies' legs, and lo and behold, Daryl Lee is actually waiting for her. He has masterminded this entire scheme.
A fake pair of ladies' legs. It's actually Harry Connick Jr.'s legs, but they do look quite effeminate, I must say. Okay, let's talk about this scene, y'all, because how, if you're a killer... This is really a lot to, like, go through.
It's very extra. I mean, I think if nothing else, this speaks to the ridiculousness that people will go to become famous, right? Like, he has this grand operatic vision that he wants to execute so that he becomes famous. And ultimately it works, because he does end up publishing a fucking book.
Wait, but that's like a dream sequence, though, initially, right?
No.
Where she
finds
the book? No.
No.
Oh, wait, that's just the beginning and the end is the end? Like, it's just like the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Dream
yeah.
sequence. And I was like, this is an awfully specific dream.
Yeah, so she does hallucinate Daryl in the audience, but that's a hallucination. But her getting attacked in the opening scene is 100%, like, that's why she becomes an agoraphobic.
No, but then the end of the movie is.
He's copycatting him.
Duh. Okay, there we go. Because I'm like, who's... Okay, how do you copy that? That's very specific.
Well, no, it's like he's going from, like, the Hillside Stranglers to the Boston Strangler to Son of Sam. And then, like, oh, also Daryl Lee Cullum.
Yeah, the magnum opus.
Yeah, well, I think... But if you take the line that Helen delivers about midway through the film, where she says she's, like, the poster woman, she's the fucking muse for all these people, it does make sense that you would try to build up to... The pièce de résistance, where you get to, like, enact revenge on this bitch who put away the guy who's actually mentoring you from prison.
For sure. But yeah, it's just such a complex way. I mean, again, A, gotta bank on no one else being in that goddamn bathroom. B, the whole strangling, like a wire over this pipe that's conveniently located over the... I mean, again, I'm not gonna get into, like...
You don't need logistics.
I'm not gonna nip it, yeah, whatever. But it works. It's really scary. And it's also, it's kind of one of those scenes where it's like, I've never seen a murder, attempted murder scene like this before, and I really like it.
Yeah, I think it's actually a great way to open the movie, because you're not expecting her to go from a lecture hall to an attempted murder, like, in the space of 2 minutes. It's just not how you think the movie will open.
The last thing she says, she's signing her book, and she's like, don't stand next to any white fans.
That sounds like ADR that was added in later, but I love it.
Yeah. And then it's like, yeah, because anything that's sketchy is clearly obvious. I'm going to go into the ladies' room now. Whoa.
Oh, yeah, the white rape van. And then we get, I kind of love the title card for this, though, where it's the cop running down the hall, and then it's like the stamp, but then it, copycat, bleh. So good.
Because that's what this movie's all about. Let's just do it 18 different ways the same.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, so we pick up 13 months later, and we zero in on Helen as she wakes up from a bad dream, but she's also still having a panic attack inside her palatial San Francisco apartment.
This apartment is so
the vapors. I will say, the one thing I really appreciate, I mean, there's lots of things I appreciate this movie, but I do love the fact that when Holly Hunter and Dermot Mulroney come in and they talk about the size of this apartment, and they talk about how much it must cost, because typically in movies people are just like, oh, what, this old shack, I've just got a couple of twigs of furniture, and you're like, it's the size of a city block, like, what are we doing here? So,
and the entire wall are like blinds, like the entire wall just kind of transforms into a window.
I mean, and yep. It's kind of one of those, like, oh, it's like, in Friends, how does this Monica chef, like, have this giant New York apartment? I guess maybe she has book sales, but, like, I don't know, like, do criminal psychologists make money to make, because San Francisco, A, is fucking expensive, but, like,
she's on the water, too.
Yeah.
The answer is, I think it's embedded in another line that she says later on, where she's like, this is the stock lecture I gave all around the country. Mm-hmm. So you can make a lot of money giving talks. Like, a lot of famous people will retire and then just give talks and live off of that.
Speaking of, though, like, real things like that, it's later, but when they come in and Holly Hunter's like, well, we can't afford to pay your usual fee. And I was like, oh, good. So she's not just volunteering for the San Francisco Police Department.
Yeah. Although I do also like that she's like, well, I'm not on duty because I'm not working for you. Like, fuck you, bitch.
She's a self-made woman.
She really is.
Yeah.
But now she's unmade.
Well, yeah. So she gets a little bit of help from her agoraphobic chat room at a workstation that, I'm not going to lie, my 2020 ass was very jealous of. She's got a good setup.
She's also rude as fuck to this bitch. Like, she's like, hey, girl, how long you been in there? 6 months? Okay, well, I'm 13 months. Bye. And, like, leaves. Like, okay.
I got you beat. Like, oh, I didn't realize we were in the agoraphobia Olympics and you were trying to come in number one.
That's what I was going to comment earlier, Kay, though, is that what I do like about Weaver's performance here is that this character is kind of unlikable. Like, she's a very frustrating, not particularly nice. Yeah, she's very prickly. And I think that you need someone like Weaver there to make it, like, to smooth out the edges a bit. But that could work the opposite way, to where it, like, doesn't come across as well as it should for some people. So,
Well, she's like super jaded, that which, you know, is also a nice contrast to Holly, who's like pretty positive and like charming and funny and religious too. I think it's a big difference. I think Sigourney has lost faith just in general, and Holly Hunter is still trying to see the good in people and humanity.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think, like, she has that line later that's like, oh, I'm going to pray. And I always thought it was a throwaway line, but that kind of makes sense, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on how you read Holly Hunter's character. Like, we don't really get to know anything about her backstory except for her relationship with men, because it's 1995,
right?
And that's the most important thing. But I think you could very easily give her that rich emotional backstory a la Clarice Starling, where, like, you know, she's Holly Hunter, so she's got that little twang in the voice. Like, she probably came from the Midwest. She came to the big city. She did well. But she still retains that belief that there's good in people and so on.
Yeah.
And yet she's so small. Like, she's short. She's, you know, just a small stature. But she commands so much power and control of all the men and the situation. She's constantly putting people in check, which I think is really interesting.
That's where you get your Clary Star. That's where someone's like, okay, we need to cast someone like Jodie Foster in this role. But so right from her introduction, though, which is where we're going next, is it's the training scene with Ruben. And then we go from that to when they find the body. And the way you see her interact, like, you can tell that she's been, like, the men respect her, but you can tell that she's had to earn that respect doubly so because she's a woman.
Yeah, and even if they do respect her, they're still willing to, like, gently kind of push her buttons mm-hmm. whenever they get the opportunity. Like, she's obviously got a bit of a cantankerous relationship with her boss, Lieutenant Quinn, who is played by J.E. Freeman.
Openly gay actor.
Oh, hi. There
you go. Yeah, he actually, no. So he was diagnosed with HIV in, like, the early 80s and continued working and had, like, a long life. He didn't die until, like, the late 2000s. But yeah, openly gay actor, just in this movie. Also, apparently he was known mostly for playing villains, so he's also playing against type here.
Yeah, I mean, I think you get the sense that he's a foil for Hunter's character. So, I almost wish we could have gotten a little bit more, because he clearly respects her, but he also isn't willing to just let her go off and do things, which is, like, such a cop movie trope, right? Like, if you look at Dirty Harry, it's, here's my badge, I'm gonna throw it all away and go and do this myself, and wait, we don't go there.
Kay, have you seen Dirty Harry?
Yeah.
Oh, God, I was like, I've never seen Dirty... I'm honored that you think that I've seen Dirty Harry, but...
Well, I think that was... I mean, I'm sure it's happened in a lot of, like, police TV shows before in some way or another. Mm-hmm. But I think Dirty Harry, that moment, became a trope. I think that a lot of movies kind of copied that formula from that point on. And Holly Hunter does try to turn in her badge. And I think, like you said, her boss is kind of a foil for her. But in that moment, he's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. We just lost 3 cops. You think I'm going to let you go? No, go get drunk and then come back tomorrow. You're still on the clock.
Yeah.
Like, again, it's just these really interesting little moments in these characters that arguably didn't have to be there. Like, they could have just made this guy an asshole boss and he gets in her way and she knows better, but he doesn't trust her. But the movie doesn't do that. It wants to make all of these supporting characters more interesting.
And they are.
And they are. Like, I would even say... I could have done with a little bit more of her, but to get into that crime scene, they have to walk past this female reporter that they call the Mouth.
The Mouth!
Who's played by Shannon O'Hurley. And, like, she only shows up in a couple of scenes. Often she's delivering the news reports that are kind of cueing Sigourney Weaver in on how the investigation's going. But I did love that, like, she's enough of a character that they gave her a kind of code name.
Yeah.
Oh, let's get by the Mouth first.
It does reek of deleted scenes, and there are others that we'll get to in a bit, but, like, they're not available anywhere, as far as I can tell.
Okay, so yeah, so basically we've established our two lead females. So we've got prickly Sigourney Weaver, who can't leave her house, and then we've got super competent Jodie Foster. No. Oh. Oh my god. Oh no.
Wow.
You could have played that as, like, a dig. I thought that was...
Yeah, really, like, I meant to do... Saucy. I actually have it in my notes earlier. I'm like, we're introduced to Clarice Starling.
All you lazy journalists from 1995.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Okay, so Holly Hunter. And she's got Ruben, which is, like, her male underling, who I kind of love. Like, she's got this banter with him, played by Dermot Mulroney. He's great. He doesn't get anything to do in this role, but he's still great.
Wait, I'm in the mind. I don't love Dermot Mulroney. I think he's always kind of, like, giving this wooden performance very much. And this is, like, the liveliest I've ever seen him be. It's, like, he's so charming in this movie. I don't know. And watching him play off of Hunter and even, like, go tete-a-tete with fucking Will Patton, it's nice to see this. And again, this is a character that also could have been just, like, I mean, killed off earlier than when he is in the film, but they keep him around, and he's honestly, like, it doesn't feel like padding to me.
No, I mean, I generally like Dermot Mulroney. I can't even say why. I'm trying to think of another role that I really enjoy him in, but I feel like whenever he shows up, I'm like, oh yeah, you, okay. But the chemistry between these two when they're at the gun range is so good. But then, yeah, you immediately get the scene where they're working the crime scene, and she just says, oh, is that the landlady? And she just dismisses him. She's like, okay, you, go off and there, do this. Yeah. Like, she just takes control, but she's also... completely in charge. Like, none of the men get to do anything, even though she knows all of their names.
Yeah,
which also impressed me.
Why? She also sends him to get her dinner. She's like, go get my food.
What, pocket cheeseburger? Yeah. Okay, so so basically the scene exists so that we can see her work the scene, but also so that we can learn that Peter Foley, the guy that we don't know exists yet, is a copycat killer in the way that he's also, like, he's killing a bunch of people, and they're like, there's a pattern, but it's not quite working. So we're supposed to be queued up that there's some kind of mystery.
It also sets up a big character element of Holly, too, because the, you know, the man shoots the kill. It's like, as soon as you see someone just like, oh, put 8 bullets into the cardboard, and she's like, no, you shoot in the shoulder. And it, which has a payoff. Oh, you mean Chekhov's
shoulder? Yeah.
No, I'm sorry, y'all, Chekhov's brachial nerve. But, again, that's good filmmaking where it's like, oh, because, again, you have these moments in films where it's like, oh, they're like, it's like the camera's like, let's close in on this really quick just so the audience doesn't forget. And this is like a smooth moment of this where it's like, you don't think to, like, that's going to come back later. So it's good.
I also like that it doesn't come back just once. Like, it comes back twice. Mm-hmm. So it really is like they're laying a lot of groundwork here.
Yeah.
Which I don't necessarily like the arc of that point, too, because it establishes that one of the themes of the film is whether or not a cop has the right to take life, even if they're a murderer. And it establishes that Holly Hunter is like, no, we don't shoot the kill. But ultimately, in the end, it feels like the lesson she learned is like, no, sometimes you gotta kill a bitch.
100%. And this does not, like, obviously you can't foretell what's going to happen in the future, but in 2020, this is like a garbage thing that does not sit well. It's like, well, oh, cops needing to learn how to shoot to kill. You're like, not.
And that's the thing. Yeah. Because the way that she ends this movie is with a completely different idea of how cops should be because of this tragedy she suffered. And it's, it's really timely. Considering how everything that's going on.
Well, at least the awareness of it,
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But, like, if no other thing, I think one of the things that recent events have illustrated is the way that we idolize police officers and have in media for just decades, right? Like, it's not unsurprising that we've got this woman as our lead protagonist and she's, like, out there working the case because that's what cops do, right? But hopefully what we're going to see moving forward is different types of stories where cops are not heroes and they're maybe not even central characters. But like in 1995, this was 100% like, oh, we want to make bank. Let's make a cop movie.
Yeah.
So we hop back to Helen so that we can get the aforementioned newspaper scene, which is basically just, hey, do you know what agoraphobia is? Here's it illustrated in a non-violent, non-scary movie. But I do like that it also has the sticker at the end where she, like, opens it up and it's details in the case. And she's like, ugh, idiots.
Idiots.
Because she's still prickly. She hasn't been redeemed yet.
It's the same scene in Invisible Man. Like, the same concept. I mean, I wonder, there's got to be other movies that do the same thing of, like, let's show how broken this person is by how difficult it is to get the newspaper.
I'm always loath to be like, oh yeah, this movie from the 90s totally inspired these other movies, because I'm sure there's something from the 80s or 70s or whatever that has inspired that as well, but I'm just going to say it. But, Copycat did it.
But Lee Winnell did explicitly say that he was inspired by a lot of like 90s thrillers, so it could be a direct reference.
There we go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so at this point, we hop to the police precinct for the first time, and we're introduced to MJ's ex, that's the Holly Hunter character, but so we get to meet Nicoletti, or Nico, as he is called throughout the film, and that is Will Patton. And we also, I don't know if you two caught this, I had never caught it until this rewatch, but Peter Foley is actually at the precinct as well.
Yeah, he is.
It's like a blink and you miss it.
Well, and because we find out later he worked at a sperm bank, so I wonder if he was like, I don't know, dropping off evidence samples of sperm? I don't know.
Well, they say that because there's Will Patton is interviewing that one guy who is like, oh, I stabbed her like 80 times, whatever. And he's like, get the fuck out of here. And they say that there's always serial killers tend to, because they're so, the egos are so big and they just kind of get off on being able to get away with things in plain sight. They kind of, it's sort of like a misdirect. It's like, oh, look, this is a classic thing that people will do, is try to get attention, but also the serial killer's just kind of like in the hallways sniffing around.
I just like it because if you are an attentive viewer, like so often in these films, there's almost nothing that can help to cue you to who the villain is. And it's funny because at this point you still think, oh, we don't know who the killer is, and in just a couple of scenes it'll be like, here's the killer.
Well, or,
taking you into his house.
I wanted to actually ask you all that. So I was thinking about this last night, because I really do like that we get to meet the killers like 45 minutes in. But do you think that it would have worked better if it was more of like a reveal at the end? But considering he's like a nobody, it doesn't really matter. Like, unless it was like fucking Will Patton who was the killer. There's, I don't know.
Well, I think that's a big part of the theme is that he, you know, he's there and, you know, he's part of the wall, you know, the wallpaper, the scenery throughout the entire movie and you didn't notice, which means just like in real life, you could be walking by a serial killer and wouldn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it does it in like little bits and drabs, right? Where we see him, but we don't know that we're supposed to be looking for him. And then the first time we see him, like, in his own actual scene, we only see his glasses, and we're getting a reflection, so we still can't really see him. So it is a nice kind of slow reveal, but I think unless it was meant to be a misdirect and the killer was actually someone that we don't know, which would have been very popular at this time, like to do a, oh, it's actually someone on the police force. Oh, maybe it's whoever's leaking stories to the media.
Do you think Will Patton was meant to be a red herring? Because at first I thought, I was like, I don't know if it's, again, the casting where I was like, yeah, you're kind of like not usually a good guy.
But don't we get like two scenes of him before we're introduced to Peter officially? So it's like, there's not even enough time to have him be a red herring.
I think the idea was more just like, let's introduce him slowly and have him, as you said, Kay, like, pick wallpaper in the background. But I don't know. Like, I'd be interested to know if they ever played with the idea that there was either a second killer or they were working in cahoots or something.
We're still a year shy of Scream by this point, so probably not.
Thank God. We don't need to give Scream credit for everything.
they invented two killers.
This was just before, you know, the horror scene changed completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Back when we were still getting adult horror with adults and not teenagers. Made it sound like a sexy adult.
I know, I was like,
that's
what?
Not the case.
Oh, but these late adults
night
fuck.
Cinema.
Yeah.
These ones are all fucking each other, so.
Exactly.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay, so this is, at this point, this is where Holly Hunter takes the phone call, the moon bike lunar cycle prank call from Helen.
Yep.
Just to, you know, like, dig it in a little bit. Yeah, her male colleagues don't quite trust her, but so Helen Hunter and Ruben
Helen Hunter?
Helen Hunter. I'm awesome at this.
You're really good.
I mean, we're trying to make sure that this episode is representative of what we normally do, and I normally fuck up the names. So.
Yeah, that's true.
Where the hunted become the Helen.
I like it.
Okay, so MJ and Ruben, I will use character names that will help me to distinguish them. So MJ and Ruben head over to Helen's house because, of course, they have traced the call back and she has made 14 of them. So she has given them plenty of evidence to be like, who is this quack? So they show up, they're greeted by Andy. He's like, cool, come on in, make yourself at home. The two women openly spar. They do not get along very well. You can tell that MJ does not trust Helen.
Well, the cops, the whole police precinct knows who she is and think she's like a loony.
I mean, it makes me wonder if she's called in to help on cases before and they've just been like, God, her again.
Yeah. I think so.
But basically, this escalates to the point where Helen has a panic attack, and Andy's like, okay, I'm going to help her with this brown paper bag, but you folks need to go. Leave the evidence if you want her to look at it, and she'll be fine. We also get a brief POV shot from the killer's perspective, and he is literally across the street looking into Helen's apartment.
Which, when you have an entire wall, that's a window, I guess.
Buy drapes, people.
He's like in his own apartment though, like across the street from her, right?
Yeah, because he also has a house, as we establish later, that he seems to live in with either his mom and or wife.
Yeah, I don't know,
could be both, could be one, we don't know.
all that sperm money.
Yeah,
so much sperm in this movie. There's actually a lot of sperm talk in this film. I'm here for it.
Yeah, okay, you would be. Okay, so we get a visual matching scene where both Helen and MJ are looking over the photos, and that, to me, is where we start to be like, these two women are very similar, they have similar thoughts and interests, and also maybe they should kiss later. So, at the end of the night, Helen takes a shower, and when she comes out of the shower, she notices that her red dress from the opening scene has been laid out on the bed, which hints that someone has been in the house to us, but to her, she's like, I'm hopped up on pills and booze, so who could say? I do like that she cops to that later, too.
She does, but she's also, like, on pills and drunk for about 90% of her screen time.
Correct. She's a woman after my own heart. I'm just saying, she's got a great setup, she's got a great apartment, and she's also drinking a lot. So Helen is basically me, is what I'm saying.
She's living the good life, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
At one point, they ask her, like, are you on meds? And she kind of changes the subject.
As she's, like, swirling her brandy snifter, like, yeah, why are you on meds?
Yeah.
I'm just drunk.
I mean, this, I sent Trace this, Kay. I didn't send it to you. I apologize. But there is actually, like, a profile, like, an online profile of Helen online done from, like, a... It, does she accurately represent agoraphobia? Does she have the right symptoms? And how would you then treat her? And the diagnosis was like, yeah, she's actually doing a pretty good job of portraying somebody with this disease. But also at the bottom of it, it's kind of like, how would you treat her? And it's like, it'd be really difficult because she's a doctor, so she'd know what you're doing. And also she's heavily self-medicating.
Yeah. Well, yes. So... yes, sorry. I had something to say about the end of the film, the original ending that was planned, but we'll talk about that later.
I do not know of this original ending.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So we get a cutesy scene where Nicoletti and Ruben fight over MJ, and it's like this big dick contest. It's, well, she's waiting for Ruben to come back with food, and Nicoletti's like, hey, do you want to go down and get some dinner afterwards, and I'll treat you right? And she's like, yeah, I'm good. And then when Ruben comes in, they like... bah, 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 bah,
bah. Oh, yeah. And he's like, yeah, treat her well. Don't cheat on her. And he's like, oh, like, you cheated on her? And I was like, whoa, okay. You all work together? What's going on here?
It's very incestuous. She's really working her way through that police precinct.
But, okay, but here's the thing. She's actually not dating Ruben, A. Yeah, so no slut-shaming there. But also, B, I just love that these two men are, like, all up in each other's business about, like, treating the woman right. Like, she's not fucking sitting right there. And also, she's working the case. And these two men are like, I want to get my dick wet. And you're just like, you two are losers. She's trying to solve the case.
Yeah.
I like it. Because it's the kind of thing where normally you would have a woman on screen and she would be like, I need a man. It's really pathetic.
Help me, I need a man.
Oh yeah, there's that one point where he's like, I'd like to propose to her, and Sigourney's like, oh, that's awfully presumptuous.
Yeah. Women just don't have time for men in this movie, and I kind of love it.
But that's why it's so good.
I think that's also why queers relate to it, is because we're just like, these people are no nonsense, they don't have time for this bullshit, and you've got these straight people over here like trying to fight it out for her honor and her hand in marriage. Like, it's bullshit.
Well, also, any notable male character in the film other than the lieutenant is murdered
or like cast aside, because Nicoletti doesn't die, but
he's out of the movie at a certain point.
Yeah, exactly. Men are just done away with in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they go to Helen, she gives them the MO, and she immediately is like, yeah, so you're dealing with the Boston Strangler. And they're all like, what?
It's a bit, okay, so I think, I'm like, that's kind of surprising they wouldn't notice that, but again, it's like, it's 1995, so they have to go, like, read books.
Yeah, and it's been 20 years, right? So it's not like, oh, this guy was just killing last week. It's like, oh, that's two decades ago, so I guess I would have been 15 mm-hmm. when this person is doing these murders in another city. As well.
Yeah.
And how many, like, stranglings must have they come across?
Apparently enough that they're just like, oh, yeah, okay, and another lady with stockings in her bathtub. Like, how often are you seeing this in San Francisco?
True, yeah.
So we are now at a pinnacle moment in this movie. This is where Helen receives a video file in her inbox. It is 30 seconds. It is too large to download. Because it is 30 seconds, that file is huge. And also, it has a virus. What? It self-destructs? What?
I find this video legitimately... this is like, I don't find this movie scary, but I actually find this video legitimately creepy. It's really, really disturbing to me. And it's, you know, it's like the girl, like, and that it's like the female Wilhelm scream where it's like, Bouja! 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 It's really creepy.
Well, it's like, what the fuck am I doing here?
Insert you two that. Are idiots. Insert that.
No, the video is definitely creepy. It's just fun to go back and look at outdated technology because it's you're just like, oh, I can't relate. A 30-second video file that is too big to download. What? Okay, sure. That's confusing in 1995. People are literally doing magic on their computers in this movie for 1995. Like, the way that they're cropping out photos and, like, putting them in and animating them. Mm-hmm. It's like, I can't do that in 2020.
Yeah, it's like, did the Riddler send this? Like, it's very...
Yes! Oh, this would have been the same year as Batman Forever.
Yeah.
How funny would it have been if there was just, like, a scene where Peter Foley's watching, like, Batman Returns on the background? Like, just like, Batman Forever.
Good idea.
Batman Forever, yeah.
I love that.
So, yes, they figure out, okay, now they know that Helen is involved in the case, and she's very pissed off. She doesn't want to be known by outside people, because she's already having a bad time of it. So she declares she's the muse of serial killers, and she has a little conniption fit, at which point Ruben is like, okay, fine, crazy lady, I will stay with you. And she's like, okay. I do like that she's basically like a slightly predatory older lady at this point. She's like, yeah, I'll allow this hot young guy to stick around.
Yeah. Okay, was there supposed to be more romance between them? I don't remember if there was. I think they originally had more of an interplay, like a more romantic tete-a-tete going on, but then they were like, nah, remove it.
Yeah, they imply a lot in a very small, short, condensed period of time, because it's like,
yes,
sort of like, will they or won't they? And the only, and then the next day she says to MJ, like, oh, tell him I said hi and thank you for last night. And it was like, oh, whoa, where's this going? And that's it.
I expect her to, like, come in with her long satin robe, her red satin robe, obviously, and just, like, swoop the staircase, like, huh,
how did this get here?
I mean, if she could transform that dress into a robe, yeah, for sure. She's already got the red, right?
I am Zool.
I mean, maybe that's the other thing. Maybe you're used to her being more sexy, like, too. Because this is not a particularly sexy role for Sigourney Weaver. And usually she is kind of, like, serving it off a little bit.
Not in, like, a sort of a typical way, but I think that her bossiness is really sexy. Like, I love her power. Even though she's vulnerable, I still like the points where she's... idiots, or like, she's like very clearly knows what she's talking about and she doesn't take much shit, which I'm like, oof.
But yeah, and but that's why her and MJ play so well off of each other. I mean, they're both the head bitches in charge.
It's true. It's a film of head bitches.
Yeah, but MJ is a little more, she's got a little more soft skills. Like, she still can, like, mm-hmm. work a crowd, and, you know, she's still, like, charming. But Sigourney's like, I'm just gonna tell you, you're gonna know exactly what I think by looking at my face.
Which, again, I deeply respect. It. I mean, I think part of it is you're supposed to read, oh, she doesn't have a ton of people skills because she's also not interacting with anybody. Think of the way she deals with that poor agoraphobe on the computer, right? You wouldn't say that to someone's face.
We're all housebound for the most part right now, so I think we can all relate without having the camera effects when we step outside.
Even if we're only stepping out to reach for the newspaper.
What's a newspaper?
Look, I'm doing it as well as she does. Okay, so we've got another body. It's this flower girl from the video, the creepy video, and she has been deposited at the top of the hill, which means, of course, that we are now dealing with the Hillside Strangler.
This is my favorite line of the movie, actually, is when they bring it back to Sigourney Weaver, and they're like, oh, like, they don't switch like that. And then she goes, consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. Okay.
I mean, she's a bit of a bitch. It's kind
of
great.
And she's also kind of horny for this, too, because she's like, horny. Very clever. When they like, he kind of, yes, like, integrates two different killers in one murder, she's like, very clever. I'm like, really? I don't... You want to give him props for that?
But I think that's important, right? Because, like, if you think of the path that we go in this type of subgenre, we end up with things like the TV version of Hannibal, where we keep getting these police procedurals where the person can literally put themselves into the perspective of the killer, right? And that's really what Sigourney is supposed to be able to do in this movie. She's like, oh, I understand exactly what their MO is because I studied them. I know everything that they'll do. So it makes sense, but it's also kind of like, oh, you're like, they're jonesing on the power, as you talk about later, and then you're jonesing on your ability to like figure them out.
Yes.
Gets her a little wet.
Correct.
Right. Which she clearly knows what she's talking about because she's pretty much never wrong.
I mean, she's published a book. She literally wrote the book on this.
Yeah, the only time she makes a false step is when she sends the message to him and then it's like, he showed up at your door. Like, you maybe shouldn't have invited him in.
And she second guesses herself with the dress. She actually kind of like counts her, like, oh, I just assumed it was me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the problem with the pills and the booze, for sure. So after this crime scene, so we get more tension between Ruben and Nico, and then MJ's like, I don't have time for this shit. So she just goes over to Helen's house. And I think to me, this is where you start to see more of the kind of lesbian overtones coming in.
Yeah.
Because they really start to get their banter flowing. They're talking about, you know, being on duty, police scanners, turning the computer on and off. And you're like, you're talking about the most mundane, stupid things, and yet it's like...
You're trying to insinuate that that's what lesbians like to talk about together?
It's more just like the way that they're reacting to one another. Like, the body language and the banter suggests that they're talking about something far more sexual, whereas the actual dialogue is like, you're talking about a police scanner right now.
I think this is the first time a police scanner has been used to queer code.
Ladies, do you police scan?
Well, and then later on in Joyride.
I am.
Yes! Oh my god.
Well, I guess that's not a police scanner, but...
It's a CB radio, but
yeah,
I'll take
we'll
it.
We'll allow it.
Lily Sobieski is not interested in either one of those boys. They're interested in each other.
Aren't they brothers?
Yeah.
Oh, they are?
I think so.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's okay, there's...
You two are disgusting.
There's porn for that.
There really is, yeah. Okay, so we get another murder. This time it's the son of Sam. And most importantly, there's a note left at the scene that cues MJ and Ruben that Helen is in trouble. And meanwhile, over at Helen's, the car alarm is going off and Peter has lured her police presence away from the door to check out this car alarm that's going off. He sneaks into her apartment. She freaks out and she cannot get more than 5 feet out of the door. She tries so hard.
Which
she bangs her head on a wall.
I will say, I mean, again, without knowing too much about agoraphobia, I'm not a scientist.
Wait, you're not a scientist? We have been doing this for 2 years and you have told me you were a scientist.
It's at least, I feel like a stupider screenplay would have been like, but she overcomes the agoraphobia and gets outside. And at least this movie doesn't take that route. I appreciate that.
Yeah, like, it's so bad that she would rather go back inside into her deadly murder mansion now then try to like face down the 10 feet of hallway she has left.
Right, exactly.
And she's able to use her giant wall blinds as like Morse code
for no
I
one.
Do enjoy that scene where she's like she's working the blind.
Yeah, she's like, oh, anyone would be like, whoa, what is going on up there?
Yeah, exactly.
Her neighbors are like, that's the one on the pills. Okay, so he ends up getting away, and I do love that Ruben sees him running, and maybe could have given chase, but instead he just opts to go back to Helen's, and he's like, yeah, sorry, we fucked up.
Yeah. Like, he could have shot him, too, but, you know.
Yeah, no, whatever. No, okay. So, this is when MJ drops everything, she hauls ass over there, and...
Anything for Helen.
Anything for Helen. So, this is the part where she... Helen's basically like, just level with me, stop treating me like I'm a fucking child. And MJ's just like, yeah, so he knows where you live, he's broken into your house multiple times, he's killed a bunch of people, you're fucked.
And you won't leave, so whoops. They can't just like put her in like a box and like ship her to a hotel room and like then she's inside a hotel room. It has to be like her space.
It has to be her space, yeah. Okay. Because, I mean, really, they could just wait until the end of the night when she's passed out from the brandy and the booze and just, like, put her into a little crate and cart her over. But I think if she woke up in an unfamiliar space, it wouldn't be good.
It would still trigger the agoraphobia. That makes sense. Okay.
Now, Trace, I know you don't do costumes. Kay, did you happen to notice in this particular scene when Helen goes through her closet and she's like, the red dress was laid out on the bed and I thought it was just the pills and the booze. Did you happen to notice that MJ is actually wearing an identically shaded red jumper and or outfit?
No.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. I get so much shit from him for not recognizing costumes.
No, I mean, you haven't talked about the score yet, and I hope you will at some point, because I was like, I didn't really notice it until you, like, sent me a bunch of sound clips.
I was saving it for the finale.
Anyway, okay. But I do think it's really important, just for this scene. I'm only going to talk about costumes in this one scene, but I think it's a transference of power where you're like, oh, these two women are literally, they're now, like, coming together in the way that they even, like, dress each other. But I think it's a visual cue that Helen should now recognize MJ as somebody who's just like her, that she can trust. Because from this point on, they're very close. Yeah. Like, MJ basically kicks the men to the curb, and it's, like, the her and Helen show from this moment on.
Well, I mean, yeah, the only thing standing between them at this point is Ruben. Luckily, that's not the case for much longer.
Not for much longer, no.
Well, I also like in this scene, too, like, so Sigourney just figured that, or Helen figured that she just kind of spaced and had moved her clothes or whatever, but MJ validates her by saying, yep. No, this is what I believe. I believe that he was here, and, you know, she's like, I don't know much more than that, but I believe you, and we're gonna figure this out.
Yeah.
Yes, oh my god, you're right. That is the moment. That's the profession of true love.
It's just a really nice moment, too, right? Like, it's almost a shame that Ruben is even there, in a way, because you're just like,
I forgot
Ruben,
that he was.
Way.
I think, because he disappears for a bit from the movie until his death scene. Like, then he comes back. Because he's in it a lot in the first half, and then, like, from, like, the hour mark to his death, he's just gone.
And Sigourney receives that, too. Mm-hmm. Helen receives that when Helen says that, she's like, thank you for being truthful with
me. Oh yeah, I appreciate your candor.
That's right.
Oh.
Yeah.
So tellingly, in the very next scene, Lieutenant Quinn, MJ's boss, is like, ooh, we think she's the leak, so we can't trust her after lunch. Oh, which is just such a read. Like, oh, she's too drunk after lunch and on, so we can't trust her. I was like, that is mean.
I didn't get that,
buddy. But he's like, yeah, don't involve Helen anymore. She's out. We don't trust her. We've got this huge task force, and we've got police, music provided by the police, so we don't need her anymore.
And I love it.
To me, that's actually the most Silence of the Lambsy that this movie gets, is that scene where she's at the front of the room, and all of the men are just, like, crowded around the table and kind of dwarfing her in size.
And you think it's a cinema moment? You're like, what? It feels kind of jarring at first, because you're like, why is there this, like, music montage all of a sudden? Or not montage, but sort of, like, it's just like, now there's a music cue, but then they, like, press stop, and then they're like, all right, what does this song mean?
Well, no, it's because you think it's supposed to be, like non-diegetic music where it's like just the soundtrack to the movie playing, and then it's like, oh no, they're actually just playing this for all these cops. So yeah, it does feel out of place, though, you're right, because nothing else in the film does this. I mean, minus the opera, I guess, that, like, every time she tries to go to the hallway.
True.
No, it's a weird moment. It's almost like a cue to tell you, hey, the movie is shifting gears, and we're now gonna, like, it's almost Helen and MJ against the world, and the targeted attacks against Helen start to escalate at this point, right?
Yeah.
Because, okay, so MJ just immediately disregards that. She goes to Helen's house. She's like, hey, so we've got this note. Let's break it down. This is where we get the MO on Peter. So it's intercut with them talking about how he's probably a normal guy. He's well-educated. He's got a decent job. And we see him working in his lab with all of the semen.
Yep. And he's got glasses.
He's got glasses.
He's nerdy.
Yeah, that's how you know he works in a lab. He's got glasses.
Also, apparently in this scene, there were originally flashbacks to his childhood, to where, like, you see, like, his... Actually, so this is what would have confirmed that the woman he's living with is actually his wife, not his mother, because there were flashbacks to his childhood, to where a woman was, like, his mother was dragging him off the bed, and he went and, like, hid in a closet and lit it on fire. Apparently, in the rest of the film, you can see slight burn marks on McNamara's forehead. I looked, and I could not see them, but Amiel insists that there is burn marks on his forehead.
We put him into hair and makeup for 2 hours every day to give him those scars. And you're like, well, we can't see them. Sorry.
But again, that's something that's like, you know, do you need the tragic backstory of why this guy's a copycat killer? No.
Absolutely not. The whole point of this guy is that he is so bland. Like, I think it's funny because William McNamara in this film, he's a total cutie patootie.
No, he's fine until the end when he's like, removes the glasses, and then it's like he's like a sexy killer,
and also because he like combs the hair back.
He parts it.
I mean, his hair is like 1995, baby. Mm-hmm. I had that hair back in 95. It was not good on me. He wears it much better than me. We'll put it that way.
This is where we insert a photo of that.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, we'll see what we can do.
He's got some hair acting going on.
Yeah, a little hairography. So this is where we get Helen and her aunts. This is, for me, like, maybe a bit of a weird misstep in the film. I don't know that we really need this, but I suppose we got to bring Robert Downey Jr. back somehow.
Harry Connick Jr. That.
Oh, you said that earlier and I was confused.
Who would have been better? Who would have been better, Robert Downey Jr. or Harry Connick Jr.?
No, I love, again, like, even, and we kind of glossed over it in the first scene, but the moment that he licks that knife, when he's like, let's have some fun, it's really good.
But shouldn't it have Evil Dead-ed his tongue? Is he not licking the sharp side?
He licked the back of it.
Okay.
And that was all him, too. That was another improvisation.
Really?
He really wanted to be a creep. They said that in between takes, he'd be singing Frank Sinatra, which is interesting.
I mean, I prefer that to the people who go so method that you can't talk to them on set because they're just constantly in character. Right. They're like, okay, Russell Crowe, take it down a notch.
But we do, I mean, again, like, this is the, I mean, well, I was going to say the last time we get to see him in the film, but I forgot the coda at the end. But we do get this webcam software, and that is one that Emil was like, yeah, we were going to do this as a phone call, but then I discovered that video conference technology existed.
I love it because, if I'm not mistaken, Demolition Man is also 1995, and they've got, like, this whole thing where they're having, like, a virtual meeting with chairs that rotate as people walk around the room, and it's, like, the chairs have a little computer screen with, like, the people's faces in it, so that it's like, this is this person from Tokyo, this is this person from New York, and it's like, the chairs rotate. I love the idea of primitive video chat where it was like, one day in the future, we'll be able to talk, but see each other. Yes, we will.
But yeah, he's creepy in this scene, and they figure out where Peter's going to be.
Well, and I think importantly, this is the start of our sequel setup that never happens, because he mentions that he has multiple disciples that are visiting him, of whom Peter is one. And we also get panties. He wants her panties.
Panties. Your squirrel covers. Your panties. I hate that word panties. It's so gross.
It's so nasty.
We should just use squirrel covers.
Yeah, squirrel covers or undergarments. One of the two. It's an either or. Okay, so they get a lead, and they're going to go and catch this. I love that it's supposed to happen in, like, the meatpacking district or something, but it never happens because poor Ruben has to get shot in a police precinct, and he's dead.
Now, Kay, did you see this coming? Did you think he was going to die?
Not at all.
Okay, good.
I kind of forgot about him because he's also just like, where do you go to pick up donuts or something? He's just like, oh, here.
Actually, no, that is what he was doing. He was just getting, that's all he does in this movie is get food.
I like it. This is what I want a man to do for me. Bring me donuts.
But now how do they get their food?
Oh.
Nobody
eats for the rest of this film.
Yeah. They had video conferencing, but Grubhub was not a thing yet.
Not a thing yet, no.
No, no.
Can you imagine what the 1995, like, the internet screen for Grubhub would look like? Just all those green words.
I think it would probably just be a picture of a sub on, like, a green background, and it would be like the sub would flash if you wanted to order it or something.
Okay, so, yeah, we go through all this drama with the police, blah, 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 blah. I want to jump to Andy's death because I think, well, there's a conversation to have here. But also, B, this could have been Ruben's death. Like, you could have had Ruben be the Dahmer kill, and they don't do that. And I think, I don't know why. Because, Joe, what did you find about this little tidbit?
So when I was doing some digging for this, I tried to do, you know, keyword searches like lesbian, copycat film, 1995, gay, copycat, 1995. And one of the articles that I found was a listicle from, I think, New Now Next or some kind of like gay site. And this film was listed on a listicle that said it was the worst representation for gays in film. And this was one of the films that they selected. And I was like, this doesn't make sense. So I click on it. And in the description, it was copycat introduces this queer character, Andy, gives him a couple of scenes. But then as soon as they introduced Dahmer, I knew that that's what they were going to do. They only made this character gay and they only included him in the film so that he could be murdered. Therefore, it's like a terrible depiction of gayness.
I don't subscribe to this theory because A, Dahmer didn't exclusively kill gay men. He also mostly killed people of color. But I don't buy into the fact that Andy is gay just so he can be killed. That's the connection that I'm having trouble making here.
I mean, I can certainly understand why someone might do a cursory viewing of this film and then think that, because you're like, here's a character who's explicitly queer, you know, very publicly talking about it, talking about going out to the clubs. He's got this gay friend that he leaves with. And it seems like we only get a little bit of him and then he gets murdered. So I could see somebody saying, oh, well, he's not really a fully fleshed out character in this film. He just is a gay man. And then he gets murdered, and he gets murdered because he's gay, right? Like, he's pinpointed at a gay bar and they go after him because of the Dahmer connection, whether you want to talk semantics of it.
That's why I kind of bring in the Ruben stuff, though, because it's like, I mean, he could have easily have just done the same thing to Ruben, but maybe because he was a cop, they were like, oh, that's not really going to work. But I personally don't view any of this as homophobic.
No, I don't either. I mean, I probably believe that the character was written for that scene, for that guy to have a Dahmer kill. I think they probably needed a gay character in there. But I mean, I think that they've done enough with the character for him to not be exclusively a plot prop.
Yeah, it's an interesting piece because I think they could have picked another serial killer instead of Dahmer and still gone after Andy and been like, because at this point, Andy is the final kill of the film before we get to the big climax. Finale. So the whole reason that Andy is killed, it's not really because he's gay. It's actually because Peter is trying to go after the person who's closest to Helen to make her hurt.
Right.
I think maybe it's because Dahmer was gay, or at least queer in some way, that's where this person's getting this from.
Yeah.
But
did Dahmer make a kill like that? I thought it was kind of like a weird kill. Because, you know, in the alleyway, was that really his MO?
I think it was just the way that they find the body, which is floating in the river headless.
Yeah, he would typically lure men or boys back to his place. It was actually weird. Like, he killed his first person when he was 18 and then didn't kill again until like 7 or 8 years later. But then like from like 87 to 91 when he was caught, it was like, you know, 17 murders. But yeah, he would typically lure people back and kill them there. He would dismember them, have sex with the corpses, but cutting the heads off was definitely something that he did. So I think that's the other thing too. Compared to the other copycat kills, which were so detailed, this one does seem a bit light on the actual copycatting, you know?
Yeah, it almost seems like it's less important that it's a copycat and more that it's going to hurt Helen.
Yes.
Because I think this is also the most emotional kill in the film. Like, this is the only character that we actually get to know in any great detail. Like, we don't know any of the women that Peter kills. And we also don't actually get to see any of them get killed, whereas we get a whole alleyway scene attack where we get this character that we know and like and don't want anything bad to happen to, and we get to see him, you know, smashed against a dumpster and an alley
fence
wall and stuff. Or
yeah, but well, and that could add to it too. I could see someone's viewing this and saying, well, there's no violence against women because we don't see any of these women get killed, but the one gay character we do. Now granted, we do see Ruben get killed, but it's far less brutal than Andy's death. But we also don't see Andy get decapitated. You know, we just see him get strangled. So I can see the argument where you're saying, okay, well, we don't see anyone else like suffer, but we see the one gay character in your film suffer.
Yeah. I just think it's interesting. Like, I'm reflecting back on the beginning of our conversation where, Kay, you said in 1995, we didn't get this kind of representation. Like, this movie is on the cutting edge because it even bothered to introduce a queer character with a name. So I think we're praising the film for doing the very same thing that this other individual is saying, like, well, you know, you just gave us this queer character so that you could kill them. And I'm like, yeah, this is what the mid-90s was. For queer representation.
But there's no malicious intent here, I don't think. Like, I don't think these people were like, let's kill the gay guy. But I get that impact and intention are very different, you know, but like, me personally, I'm not negatively impacted by the implications of this kill. But if you are, by all means, like, totally, you do you.
I think the worst case scenario here is that writing the script, they had like a list of, you know, all the serial killers, and they were like, which ones should we use? And you know, the Dahmer thing, they're probably like, oh, well, maybe we can tie that in to the plot. But I don't think it was anything more than that. I think if anything, they're just trying to Dahmer, well, I guess everyone's pretty big name. I'm trying to think of like who they may have.
I think they name a couple of other people though. Like, they mentioned Gacy, but then I think that would still be a gay kill.
That would, yeah. Well, that would be more of a pedophilic thing too, I think.
I think that's a little more cartoony. If they had done that, I think it would have like distracted. I think the other killers, they're still enough where it's like, they're pretty straightforward kills, even if they were like printed elaborately, their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I actually do wonder if they did a Gacy kill, if like he would have actually gone in full clown garb. We also don't get the Ted Bundy kill. Like that's the one that's listed. But again, if it was Ted Bundy, it would have been killing a woman.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. He would have lured her into his, what, gold
VW bug. Yeah. Mm-hmm. With a cast on his arm.
I'm actually surprised. I kind of thought that he was going to show up at Helen's with his arm in a cast just to, like, prove that he could fool her.
Let's talk about this because I was always really confused. And I need to know if y'all agree. Whenever he opens the door and he slits the cop's throat, she looks out the peephole and it looks like the two cops, meaning the cop and Peter, are just standing there like having a laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And then she opens the door and all of a sudden like the knife's at the guy's neck. I've always, like, this is the one part of the film that I'm like, I don't understand it. Like, did the cop know him? Did he just walk up to be like, hey, I'm relieving you of your duty now. I don't know. I just never got that.
I always interpreted it as don't make a scene or else I'll kill you. Just get her to open the door. So look like everything's fine.
Okay, did you have the same thing?
I thought they were pretty chummy. Like, it seemed like genuine, but I guess it would have to be the relieving of the scene, relieving of like the duty or whatever, because why would they be, other than the, like, you know, the blue code, the brotherly thing or whatever, that I'm just like, why are they
the blue code
there? Why are they there together to begin with?
Maybe that's why he has the house across the street, because he's there so that he can pose as the police officer who like rotates through, because it would be really hard to go. I think we're overthinking it, but
It is confusing, and also kind of a throwaway kill. I mean, in a way of like, is that wasn't really,
yeah. It's also like the
boxes,
like one of the only moments of like genuine like gore that we get in the film with that blood spray.
I like it.
Oh, I did too. It's great. Okay, take us home.
Sorry, in between these scenes that we were talking about, Peter has also destroyed his home and killed his wife, mother.
Oh yeah, there's a whole. Oh, that's also very Silence of the Lambs though, where the cops go, and it's not the wrong house this time, but it's like, you know, he's not there.
Yeah, I definitely thought that they were setting it up that he had rigged everything and he was going to just blow everybody up, kind of like in Speed. But in this case, he's like, no, he just left a couple of cans of gas lying around so that there's a fire. Right. But like, it doesn't seem like anybody really dies, which is kind of funny. He's
yeah.
Like, no, it's just a distraction.
Well, because she's already dead, so.
Okay, so time for the final copycat. So at this point, Peter has broken in. He has punched Sigourney Weaver in the face a couple of times. And then MJ finds a video inviting her to come to the scene of the crime where it all began, if she's a smart cop. So we wake up with Helen. She is back in the bathroom at the university. And she wakes up as the noose goes around her neck in the bathroom stall. And Peter is just so pathetic. at this point. Like, he thinks he's so cool recreating the scene of Daryl Lee, and she could not give two shits about him.
I think, no, this is her, like, all right, I'm gonna die, fuck it. Like, I'm gonna get this fucker and just make him feel shitty before he kills me.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point, like, hypothetically, she would also be facing down her agoraphobia because she has woken up in a new environment. So I think she's very much like, the only way to conquer this is to, like, put on my professional hat and try to just, like, meet this person where they're at, which is, I'm not taking your shit because I know everything about right. you. Okay, so he then assumes an early groundwork scene from Saw where he pretends to be the dead cop so that when MJ comes in, he is there and he can surprise her.
I love the way that's framed, though. Like, I actually think that one thing Emil does really well is, so in the beginning when he, like, the cop has the gun out and, like, you don't, it, like, Daryl doesn't just pop out. It's like, you see his hand come up and grab the gun where it's, like, really slick and easy. And then this one, you have, like, you know, MJ going around and you just see Peter as the dead cop, like, turn his head and, like, slick. It's very, you know, Halloween-y, but I love it.
I like that it doesn't rely on a lot of jump scares. Like, I think that's why people don't find that this film is particularly scary, but I find that it works on an atmospheric level. Like, it's got a really good tone to it.
Yeah.
This scene in particular, like the scene in sort of the setting of the bathroom, it was very intentionally made to evoke the Psycho shower scene.
Really?
In fact, a lot of interviews, it was a talking point in a lot of the interviews, both the director and Sigourney kind of talking about, and it sounded a little bit forced, but they're like, we want to do for public bathrooms what Hitchcock did for the shower.
If I have to, no, no.
It's a, I heard that too, and I was like, y'all.
You can't make those kinds of moments. You can't deliberately set out to be like, we're going to scare people off of using public toilets. Come on.
Can you imagine, though? Like, I was honestly more bothered by the fact that she was like, it's a very pristine bathroom, and like, she's like, you know, putting the toilet paper down in the seat. I mean, maybe that just really speaks to my personal hygiene, but like, that was a very clean bathroom.
You could eat off the floor of that bathroom. Come on.
It's all white.
It's so white.
Which is like, not what you find in like college campuses, because that bitch would be impossible to keep clean if you had students trampling through there all the time. Absolutely mm-hmm. not.
Mm-hmm. No, and it's no. huge.
It's massive. Yeah.
So your alternate ending, by the way, is that MJ was going to be in trouble and Helen was going to conquer her agoraphobia and kill Peter. And apparently they did film this and they did test screen it, and audiences didn't find it believable that Helen would be able to conquer her agoraphobia. And so they were like, oh.
What's our plan B then?
Reshoots.
Which I agree with. Like, I think she does a reasonable job of fighting back. Like, again, it's difficult not to see Sigourney Weaver in a role where she's just like, literally like punching this guy's face through the back of his skull. But right. I think she actually does get a couple of nice empowering moments. Like, she sees that MJ's in trouble, so she sacrifices herself, which is like,
yeah,
it's such a like female thing for their male counterpart. So I love that it's like the older female mentor is actually doing it for her younger colleague here. Like, it feels like a really nice gendered inversion that yeah. I'm also here for. And then she stabs him in the fucking leg. She sprays him in the eye with cleaner, which I love is cleaner as well, because that's what he used to kill that other girl.
And okay, this is like my geeky, like, I'm a 90s slasher kid moment, but like, so Christopher Young did the score for this. Christopher Young has like a bunch of scores, but this is like the one that I remember the most, because the music in this scene, it's like this da 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 da. It's used in the trailers for both Scream and I Know What You Did Last Summer. And so when I saw this movie, it was after I'd seen those trailers, and I was like, this sounds so familiar. That's why. I love it. And it's really good. And we got, like, you know, Sigourney running out, like, da, na, 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 na. That's my rendition of this score.
Is that what he was doing? Okay, I didn't get that. Did you get that?
It's okay. We'll just put a YouTube clip over it.
No, I mean, this is all really good. I feel like at this point, I had forgotten that this part of the movie existed. I thought everything ended in the bathroom. So when she's, like, running down the hall and going up the stairwell,
the roof, like, yeah.
Going with this.
Did y'all put up your dukes? Like, she's just delirious at this point.
I mean, it's safe to assume that he maybe also drugged her to keep her out. So mm-hmm. I don't know whether she's operating.
He injected her before he took her to the room.
Right. Yes. This is gonna hurt. Okay, oh, yeah. Peter.
He says it a lot.
He's just so pathetic. He's so wimpy. You're just like, you're not scary. Even the part where he's like, oh, like, he's clearly getting camera ready before MJ comes in. Like, that's why he takes off the glasses and combs his hair, because he wants to be immortalized. You're like, you're sad.
Yeah.
Actually, if you think about it, this is kind of Scream 4. Sort of
he wants to be famous. He wants fame.
Yes.
Or just by copying someone else's MO.
Yeah, it treats it kind of like a virus where it's like, oh, one killer breeds other killers who want to imitate their fame and blah, 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 which, again, I think is a really nice take on it.
Yeah.
And it's also the way that line is said earlier in the film is sort of an indictment on men, too, because she says, these men are like viruses. There's always a new mutation.
The movie's sexist, guys. It hates men.
Where are all the female serial killers in this movie? Come on. Maybe that would have been the sequel.
Yeah, well, you know, let's do this. So yeah, MJ blows out What's-His-Face's brains because she learns that cops need to kill people.
Yeah, don't just shoot him in the shoulder. Pump him full of lead.
Although I do love the brain splatter that once we get the headshot on him. It's really good. Do we like the coda? Because we're done now. We're done with MJ and we're done with Helen. Like they're out of the movie. She, I'm assuming, is brought back home to be cared for by MJ.
Yes, they live happily ever after in her palatial San Francisco apartment with her mm-hmm. giant computer setup. Yeah. And then we cut back to the prison where Daryl Lee is writing a letter to a new disciple. And he's saying, this other guy fucked it up.
So come and do it. I love he has like a giant like blow up of Peter's driver's license too, like right behind him.
Yeah. Just in case you forgot who I'm talking about, this guy.
It was a fax. He got a fax over.
Yes!
He's already used his one video call for the year, so they had to fax the picture over.
So I really do like this ending. I think it's really creepy. I don't know what a sequel would look like without being the same thing. I guess you just maybe wouldn't call it copycat. Like maybe it wouldn't be a copycat killer. I just kind of hate that
many other killers. That, you know, they could have just kept going through all the other.
Right, which is very true. I'm just trying to think of like how that would be different than this one, you know? Like, it's like the whole thing of like with the sequel, oh, well, it's just a rehash of the first movie. I guess in this one, you would have maybe her and Helen and MJ be more of a team from the get-go, since all that, like, animosity is out of the way. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would 100% watch a legacy sequel if it came out next year.
Can you imagine?
Or series. This would be a great series. It's been a long time since I've seen it, and I only watched a few episodes, but remember Kevin Bacon did that show called The Following? It's actually very similar.
Yes, that's from Kevin Williamson.
Yep, Kevin Williamson mm-hmm. created that. Make it better, and yeah, for sure, absolutely.
I actually think that this, to me, the spiritual sequel of this is The Bone Collector, the Lincoln Rhymes one, is it quadriplegic or just paraplegic? But they tried to turn that one into a television series with one of the guys from that terrible NBC show where he could see demons. Wow, I'm sorry. Okay.
No, I know, but it got canceled after one season. I remember when I found that out. Yeah, I guess you could do it. Like, I would rather see it done Hannibal Lee. I guess it would need it to be gory. But like, I mean, can you imagine a show where like, a procedural like every other week was like a new famous serial killer copycat murder? Like, I mean, probably actually it would be gorier. They would make it way gorier than this video is.
Yeah.
Led by two women.
But it could mm-hmm. be interesting, right? Because you could still play with that idea that the killer is actually zeroing in on Sigourney. Like, you could still have that through line of her being sort of like stalked or like gently being threatened throughout the course of the season and then built up to something similar to what we get in this film. That would 100% work.
Yeah. But as it stands, I like the way the movie
ends. She's got the same luck. She's got the same luck as Sidney Prescott.
Yeah.
Maybe the next movie is just her in therapy, though, trying to overcome that agoraphobia once and for all, because that's the real villain.
Just like, it's okay, MJ. I just made my first appointment to meet with this nice doctor, Dr. Lecter.
Oh my God. Brian Fuller, take copycat. Awesome. But you know, as I said, I mean, I love this movie. I think it's a fucking fantastic movie. It's a 5 out of 5 for me. I love that we get to talk about it on this, but yeah, I mean, I could watch this any day of the week. Bring it on.
Yeah, I hadn't seen this movie probably in about a decade, and I found that I vividly remember whole scenes, whole sections of dialogue. I just find Holly Hunter and Sigourney Weaver are such amazing actresses, and this role, putting them together and letting them play off of each other, like, and presenting them as kind of no-nonsense women that don't need men in their lives and literally get rid of the men in their lives so that the film can progress. It's just like, it's everything that I want if I'm going to watch a kind of straightforward crime procedural.
I love, well, I've seen it twice now. And it is really great. It is, and I could definitely, you know, I'm never really compelled to watch The Silence of the Lambs or Seven. I feel like they've made enough of an impact, but Copycat, it's the same thing. It's the performances. It's particularly Holly Hunter, I think, just in everything she does. I mean, I adore Sigourney as well, but Holly is able to make the tiniest line, the tiniest gesture, the tiniest like flick of an eye mean something. And I could just watch her literally do anything.
Right. I mean, like, she won an Oscar for a silent role.
Yeah. It's one of those things where I feel like almost like cinema doesn't quite know what to do with her because she's not like the usual actress. So she's had this weird career trajectory where she just really, like, I know that people feel like she's gotten her dues, like she's got a fucking Oscar, she's appeared in a Batman movie, blah, blah, blah. But how are we not seeing Holly Hunter movies coming out every couple of years and her getting like really good meaty roles?
I will have you know that Little Black Book with her and Brittany Murphy and Kathy Bates is an A+ rom-com in my opinion.
Okay. Right. Not where I thought you were going to go, but that is a total Trace move. Yeah.
It is. Yeah,
name
it
drop
is.
Some random rom-com.
It's really in the Holly Hunter pantheon.
Yeah. I mean, it's better than Batman v Superman, so mer.
Well, but you don't want to hear her talk about piss for a couple of minutes? Let's do this. Just forget it. Yeah. Let's purge that. It's terrible.
It's
or watch it next year on HBO Max.
Yeah. The Snyder Cut. It's great. Wait, no, that's Justice League. Fuck, sorry. Okay, well, yeah, so that's going to wrap up Copycat. First of all, Kate, thank you again for inviting us into your festival and letting us, well, taint the lives of all your subscribers.
Yeah.
It's subscribers, attendees.
It taint bad.
Well, it's a little bit of both this year. And I our audience, a lot of them are familiar with you guys. So it's a pleasure to be here. I'm so glad that you guys could be part of it.
I mean, I'm just super glad too that we could ask you to be on this particular episode because we have been trying to pin you down for like a good 6 months.
Yeah,
so
we
it
have.
Feels like this is it taint a bad move to invite. No. I just love the fact that we got to appear at your festival, but also to have you on the episode, because everybody else that you program can't say that they get to do this with you. That makes us better.
And it was a great film. I never seen it before, so I'm glad that...
I know, we could have made you watch something shitty.
Well, like, you know, shitty movies can be fun to talk about, but this is a movie that I'll definitely continue watching.
Oh, good. Okay.
Well, good. And I think that'll close us out. So on that note, we can cross out Copycat.
Yes. And cross out Horror Queers.
Disgusting Podcast Network, home of creepy, disturbing, and terrifying creepypastas. SCP Archives, weekly full cast storytelling, Horror Queers, genre commentary from an LGBTQ perspective, and the Boo Crew, horror-centric interviews. Listen free wherever you stream audio and at bloodydisgusting.com/podcasts.